something, pulling strings, undoing things. He likes that.
So he is smarter than, you know, when you think of the main domesticated pets, we have cats and dogs. I mean, in terms of the ability to learn and to experiment, I presume superior intellect.
I would argue that. Yes, I would think that personally. I think he is, and he would give you an idea. The first time he was ever presented with this, he hasn't seen this problem for nearly 3 to 4 years, and he only saw it once then. And I presented it to him, and I didn't show him initially. I didn't want to show him how to solve it. And it took him, I think, probably about 30 seconds to work out how to
get
it.
That's what makes corvids so special, that you can give them a completely novel problem, and they somehow work it out. And just going back to what Lloyd was saying, corvids live in a particular kind of environment, and the kind of searching behaviour and the inquisitiveness that you've just described, that's kind of... that reflects the environment in which they live. Parrots are also incredibly clever, but they live in a very different environment, and they would be clever in very different kinds of ways.
Yeah. We've done tests like this. Corvids are the ones that the crow family that are best known for having, you know, really intelligent kind of appearance to them. But we've done tests with kias, alpine parrots in New Zealand, and also with a bird called the striated caracara in the Falklands. And we took in these tests, which they'd never seen before, which were Perspex tubes with a food reward at the top. And the only way they could get at it was to operate a series of different levers, and the food reward would be presented at the bottom. And the first time that you place it out, first of all, these birds are following you around everywhere. They're a bird of prey. They're quite menacing looking. It's like something out of Hitchcock's The Birds. And the first time you put down this Perspex tube, it's very much like Brown did there. They peck at it. They pull at everything. And eventually, after about 10 minutes, by pure chance, the food reward falls out. The intriguing thing is what happens when you put it back a second time. Because the second time, they do the whole maneuver in about 2 minutes. And the third time you put it out, they solve it instantaneously. So it's not necessarily that they're figuring out how to do it from the start, that they're solving this problem going, oh, I need to twist that and the other, but they remember the way that they solved it the first time round.
Yeah. Well, those of you who know the British Sign Language applause, go for that, because I know some people down the front did that. So thank you very much, Lloyd, and thank you very much, Brian. That was absolutely fascinating.
Thank you.
Brilliant.
Thank you.
This is what I love, really making the Radio 4 listener work with their imagination.
Well, I thought, I mean, just to sum up, I mean, there's clear intelligence there, problem solving, understanding language. He mimics as well, apparently. So on the scale of other animal intelligences that we know of, where would you place the most intelligent birds?
In the last decade or so, there's been a resurgence in trying to understand bird intelligence. And the people that study corvids in particular, but also parrots, have kind of tried to raise their profile. So they're regarded by a lot of people as being on a par with chimpanzees. And as I say, it's corvids and parrots. And if you look at their relative brain size, they have relatively large brains. But I think it's easy to deceive yourself. I studied bullfinches, which is kind of the antithesis of Bran, a little songbird, and they also have tremendous intelligence. They also have a very big brain, but their intelligence manifests itself in another way. Like ravens, corvids, parrots, bullfinches form very long-term, rigorous pair bonds with their partners. And maintaining a pair bond is actually something quite complicated, because you have to be able to anticipate what your partner is going to do. And so there seems to be fairly strong evidence across a range of animals that when you have a long-term pair bond, you need a lot of cognitive power.
What's the most intellectually disappointing bird? Because I always say, you know, no one's a big fan of pigeons generally, are they?
Pigeons are nothing like as dumb as they're made out to be.
Exactly. The guillemot that I've studied for 45 years used to be called the foolish guillemot. And that's because when they're faced with a predator, be it a raven or a gull or a human being, they sit tight on their egg or chick, because that's their strategy that works for ravens and gulls, but it doesn't work for humans. But for humans, it was easy, because you could just go and pick them up and either kill the bird or take the egg. But they're anything but stupid. In fact, there's probably no bird that's really stupid.
Are chickens are stupid?
No, chickens are incredible.
How would they manage to cross roads if they were so stupid?
let me give you an example of how smart chickens are. We did some experiments, and we were interested in the mating behaviour, of course. And I discovered that if you very gently held a hen in your fingers and lay on the ground and pointed the hen's bottom towards the cockerel, he would go, whoa, fantastic, and jump on it and mate with it. And then we fitted the female with a kind of chastity belt that we could collect the sperm, which is the kind of stuff that biologists do. And... we wanted to know how many sperm a cockerel could transfer to a female. And so what we did was we put the female behind our back and the cockerel would wander around, we'd put her out again and he'd come and mate and we'd collect the sperm and count them. And then after a bit, we swapped the hen. So it was a different hen. And he suddenly just started transferring many, many more sperm. And we did it again and again. And then we noticed what he did was every time, before he mated, he had a quick look at her face. And they go, oh, it's you, love. I'm not gonna bother. if it gave him a new one, he goes, whoa. And we did it time and time again. They are super smart.
Wow. Playboy chickens.
I'm just radically rethinking what I think of as smart behaviour now in relation to the pub on a Friday night.
The facts in research in this programme, we found a fact that the 2003 Ig Nobel Prize for Biology was awarded to the first recorded case of homosexual necrophilia in the mallard duck.
Now, I was going to ask about this because I have seen ducks where I live doing it, and it is the most extraordinarily violent and distressing thing I've ever seen. I felt the need to intervene at times just for the poor female duck. Is the female duck hating it as much? I mean,
absolutely.
It looks appalling.
No, it is appalling. And sometimes females get drowned because most of the copulations take place on the water.
Amazing.
But therein lies what I think is probably the most fascinating story about bird sex you're ever going to hear. So in lots
lay it on me.
In lots of duck species,
the male
has a penis. Not many bird species have a penis, but the male duck has a penis. And the mallard is the one that you will all have seen, the duck, but not the penis. And the penis is the most remarkable structure. It's completely unlike a human penis. And it's a spiral structure, and it's folded away in a little pouch inside the cloaca near the vent, and it's erected by lymph rather than blood, and it's an explosive device so that when the male comes in contact with the female, bam, this thing goes off and it spirals its way up the female's reproductive tract. Now, because males have got a penis, they can force matings onto females, and so it's called forced extra pair mating, basically rape. And
oh my God.
Different species of ducks have different sized penises. And a few years ago, a paper was published in Nature about the Argentine lake duck. And the duck is about this long, it's about a foot long, and its penis is about 18 inches long. And all the text in the paper was about what the male might do with this enormous structure. And because it was to do with sperm competition, we thought, well, maybe he uses it to remove sperm from previous matings. And everything was male orientated. And I said, actually, what happens to the poor old female? Where does all that penis go? So we started a study to look at this. And we looked at the anatomy of the female's vagina by picking up roadkill. Birds in the spring are killed in huge numbers on the road and you can dissect it. And so we dissected some female ducks. And my postdoc said to me, I think you'd better come and have a look at this. There's something a bit weird about this. So every previous bird vagina I'd looked at was just a straight tube. This one had a little side branch and a bit of a spiral structure. To cut a long story short, we looked at a lot of different duck species, and the duck species that have the longest penis, the females have the most complex vagina. And in the most complex situation, there are three side branches and a very rigorous spiral. Now, I mentioned that the male's penis is also spiraled. The female's vagina spirals in the opposite direction. You could not devise a better way to stop a male in its tracks. And what I imagine happens is that when the female is forcibly mated by a male she doesn't want, all she has to do is to clench her oviduct and the spiral tightens, and he's sent off down one of these blind alleys where he can't do much trouble.
I'm never taking my 3-year-old son to the village duck pond again.
This is going to be a very interesting show to see which parts of it end up in the bit that goes out during the school run, and which goes out in the podcast version.
Can you better that story of a bird mating?
Do you know what? I'd actually rather you didn't, because I'd like something. Otherwise, half this show is just going to be half to the sound of various different bird life calls.
It's quite tricky, because actually the majority of birds don't have a penis. In fact, they just have a cloaca, and most mating is what's called cloacal kissing, where the two cloaca come together, can be very, very brief, and there isn't this extraordinary elongated penis that you get in the Argentinian lake duck. But one of the most incredible things is that some of the birds that we see in our gardens all the time, that appear to be the most common, the least sort of interesting of all, have the most extraordinary sex lives. And one of those would be the dunnock, a bird which is a real common garden visitor here in the UK, and is an absolute deviant. I mean, they come up to the mating season.
You say deviant, but he's just enjoying life.
Yeah, no.
Let's not judge them.
That's fair enough. Well, except for the fact that coming up to breeding, the male's testes swell to about 8% of its body weight, which would kind of be like me having testes the size of a sack of potatoes. And then they will mate 30 plus times every single day.
I know some of that laugh there come from people. People just remembered some of the trousers you wore in Strictly Come Dancing. See if there were any clues as to what time of year. I think you're fine.
With multiple different partners, there are some birds that you will their nests have been examined, and 98% of those nests contain eggs from different parents. And birds that may appear to be monogamous actually are really sneaky and a bit dodgy.
Female birds, don't they? They try and sort of keep all three or four males guessing as to who might be the parent.
So we studied a bird called the Vasa parrot, which is probably the world's ugliest bird. It's a very big black parrot. But its main claim to fame is that the male has what we call the cloacal protuberance. And it's about the parrot's about 18 inches long, and this structure is about the size of a tennis ball. And a colleague of mine, who was the curator of birds at Chester Zoo, phoned me up one day. He said, I think you ought to come over here and have a look at our Vasa parrots. They're mating at the moment. And as Steve has said, most copulating birds, it takes about 2 seconds. These Vasa parrots were stuck together for half an hour, and the male inserts this structure into the female and actually forms what's called a copulatory tie, just as in dogs. And they just sit side by side. He's presumably whispering sweet nothings in her ear. And
she's eating Jaffa cakes. Have I given too much away? I opened the book a bit too wide there, I think. Maybe.
And we thought, you know, this is fantastic. My guess is that this must be something to do with sperm competition. Nobody knew anything about Vasa parrots in the wild. We went to Madagascar, did a study, and sure enough, it is the most remarkable avian mating system. For females, own the nest. It's a hole in a tree. She comes out, sits on the top of another tree and sings. Not many female birds sing. She sings, and males fall out of the sky to form a queue to copulate with her. And that lots of them copulate with her. And then when we did the DNA fingerprinting on the chicks, every egg has got a different dad.
So is most of what we see, Steve, in terms of that we interpret as beauty within birds, you know, whether it may well be the dawn chorus, whether it is plumage, all of it pretty much down to some level of sexual selection?
Very much so. So the norm amongst birds is for the male to be the most ornamented. There are exceptions to that, but generally speaking, the male solicits the attention of the female, and that can be in the most extraordinarily dramatic ways you can imagine, from the bowers of the bowerbirds in New Guinea and Australia, which are these, they're part of what Richard Dawkins referred to as the extended phenotype. They're an extra part to the character of this bird, which is not a nest, it's a construction that's created to attract the attention of female birds. And I've been lucky enough to be wandering through the forests of New Guinea, and you'll see what looks like a latticework igloo with an array of different beautiful objects laid out in front of it, which the bird has selected to make it more beautiful. I've even been to particular bowers in Australia where, in place of natural objects of beauty, this particular bowerbird had discovered some poor child's toy plastic soldiers. So in amongst all of the bulbs and the beautiful beetle casings were a whole bunch of, you know, little plastic soldiers. There's one called the satin bowerbird, which erects a beautiful bower with an avenue running down the centre of it, and then in front of it puts out all these beautiful blue items, and they would usually be blue petals from flowers, for example. Now they're filled with, you know, blue plastic biro tops and plastic straws and things, and you can sit in front of the bower and remove something blue and replace it with something red, and the adult bird, the male bird, will fly down and caw in your face and rip out the blue thing and throw it, the red thing, and throw it away so that his perfect structure is there in place to attract the female.
We've heard this remarkable descriptions of the variety of behaviour. We've seen some of the behaviour with the raven, remarkable behaviour. To go back to your initial statement about birds and feelings that you said you'd like to know, I mean, just to draw this to a close, what would be your guess? I mean, how do we characterise how, I suppose, whether there is an internal, some kind of internal monologue there in birds? It's a very difficult question. But
it's such a difficult question. That's one reason why it hasn't been studied. I've taught animal behaviour to first year undergraduates for more years than I care to remember. And I'm constantly frustrated by the fact that academics kind of work within a very narrow rut. You know, there are certain things that it's legitimate to study. There are certain things that we wouldn't touch. And early on, when Nico Tinbergen, who founded the study of animal behaviour, he said, we don't do animal emotions. That's too complicated. It's too subjective. Luckily, now things are changing slightly. And you only have to have kept a dog or a raven to realise that these animals do have emotions, they have personalities. And it's only in the last few years that we've been brave enough to say, OK, let's accept this and then devise ways in which we can study it. But it's still, I was talking to Lloyd before we came on, his raven definitely has emotional responses, but they're difficult things to measure and to quantify in a scientifically rigorous way. I know that sounds very boring, but that's the fact.
I'm not saying this is scientific, but I will say Bran, before the show started, took me to one side and said, if I wasn't already with someone, I'd definitely be interested. So,
to be fair, I think he was mainly interested in your Jaffa cakes. So we, as usual, asked our audience a question as well, and we asked them, if you could teach a parrot one sentence, what would it be and why? And this one is just quark, to confuse people as to whether it's a physicist parrot or just a posh duck.
Don't eat me, I'll only end up repeating on you.
Nice.
Strong and stable.
One here, I think, exercising excellent pop culture judgment. Things can only get better, the best lyric ever written.
So thank you very much to our wonderful parent panel, who Tim, Katie and Steve. And we should, now we've got to the end, we should say, well, a couple of little notes.
We've had an edict from Radio 4. As many listeners will know, BBC Radio 4 is actually powered by the number of complaints it receives. If no one's outraged, disgusted or miffed, then the generator starts to fail.
And now, see, in the old days, we were always received, well, we received a very large number of complaints. The first section of complaints were about the fact that the infinite monkey cage may well be cruel to animals. This is entirely true. How seven monkeys haven't written a Mills and Boone, so how can an infinite number write Macbeth? And we used to receive hexes from witches. And this, unfortunately, all of this has dried up. We used to get so many complaints, it created so much energy that we actually managed to power an automated walk-in bath for Nicholas Parsons.
So before Radio 4 fizzles out due to accidental listener contentment, we've been instructed to make umbrage by taking over Radio 4 for a day and making it more evidence-based and compliant with the laws of nature.
So the shipping forecast will now become the climate change forecast. There will be stormy conditions for boats sailing into the port of Leicester. Yeah. That'll get Nigel Lawson annoyed enough to power a couple more shows.
Desert Island Discs will be cancelled due to rising sea levels.
The Archers will be genetically modified. Wait until you hear the size of those cows.
And Richard Dawkins will be presenting Thought for the Day.
There's no such thing as fairies. Anyway, so, and John Humphreys will be forced to talk about a technological innovation without sounding like he's the kind of man who would smash a loom.
So there you go. So if you're going to complain by email, please use caps lock and email to /dev/null@bbc.co.uk.
Yes, it's Brian's classic Unix joke. Thank you very much. Bye-bye. Bye.
Turned out nice again.
Hello, I'm Robin Ince.
And I'm Brian Cox.
Today we are talking about health, which is a lot more interesting to me than it is to Brian, because I am a human and therefore may well become ill, whereas he is a replicant that was made in Switzerland and is only poorly if we have to reboot him when he's just there going, wonderful, 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 wonderful. Now, medicine has moved on. Medicine has moved on a lot in the last 100 years. The best cure for being ill used to be leeches, cutting and newt spit, in which way I really mean the best cure for being ill was to kill you, because then you didn't have flu anymore. You were merely dead.
This is why homeopathy was relatively successful, actually, because it did absolutely sod all and therefore didn't kill you, which was a measure of success. At least you were alive. Sorry, there's going to be letters, aren't there?
Well, this water's already been telling me you've been very bad. Ooh, it's got a horrible memory. Today, we'll be talking about medicine that works. In fact, a medicine without which many of us would not be alive today. Antibiotics.
How do antibiotics work? What are the consequences of their overuse? And what can we do to fight bacterial infections in the future?
To prolong our painful existence and postpone our inevitable demise, we have a panel of distinguished guests, and they are...
Well, I'm Dame Sally Davis. I'm the Chief Medical Officer for the UK. So I'm concerned with the health of every one of you in this room and the nation. I advise the government. And I'm particularly concerned about the increase of infections that don't respond to the treatments.
And I'm Martha Clokey. I'm a professor of microbiology at the University of Leicester, and my research is on bacteriophages, which are viruses that specifically kill bacteria, and we'll talk more about them later. And that the organism I've been working on for the last decade is a thing called Clostridium difficile. Many of you may not know this bacteria. It's not a particularly sexy bug, but it's a major cause of infectious diarrhea in the Western world. But in terms of working with it, it has a particular smell of horse urine. So once you actually found it, you know that you've got it in the lab. And when you look at the colonies on a plate, they are a particular chartreuse colour. So it's being pragmatic. It's not a good bug to get, but it's you can work with it.
Sick green, if you wish.
Yeah,
chartreuse, right.
I'm Chris Addison. I'm an actor and comedian and director, and I love being introduced lower down the bill than diarrhoea and urine. Found my rightful place at last. And the disease that interests me most is Kuru, which was a disease of the Papua New Guinean people.
Still is.
Is it still? So you can tell me. So as I understand it, it was called the laughing sickness, was it not? So it was because one of the symptoms of Kuru is this sort of spasmodic, uncontrollable laughter. It's like the Dead Riggins audience. And there's no explanation for it, but they're laughing anyway. So it was caused by the religious beliefs of the Papua New Guinean people, who believed that eating the departed would help free their souls, and they would... especially give the food, as it were, to mothers and children. So it was particularly
the brain.
It's the brain, isn't it, that they yeah. eat.
The prion. Yeah.
And this is our panel, and all we have time for today. Now, because of the way this has been set up, I don't think we should go to question one. I want to preamble before that. Martha, you said that you worked with a not particularly sexy bacteria. How do we define the sexier bacteria?
Well, I would say sexier ones are generally more heard of. So everyone knows about MRSA, and everyone knows about maybe Salmonella, E. coli. But Clostridium is just a sort of just people don't sort of think about it as much as they should.
You could take gonorrhea.
For what? What's that going to cure me of? You sound like one of the more maverick homeopaths. Don't dilute it. Water, just have the whole gonorrhea. That'll get rid of your headache. You'll have something else to think about.
I just thought it's an interesting one. You want a sexy one. It's transmitted through sex. It's on the rise. And we now have patients dying across the world because there's no treatment for them.
Becoming
you sort of said that like it's an achievement.
Well, it is the bug, isn't it?
Yes, well done, yeah. Gonorrhea. Full marks.
So, Sally, to start, could you tell us how an antibiotic works?
So antibiotics only work against bacteria. and they work by killing. They're absorbed through the bacterial wall into the inside, and they poison it by interacting with the metabolism. Each antibiotic family works in a different way. But it's very interesting that survival of the fittest, it's quite easy over time for the bacteria to have a mutation and become resistant. And it's also a big group of the bacteria have two cell walls. They're called the gram-negative ones. So it's actually very difficult to get the antibiotic in to kill it in the first place. So we need to get high levels in the blood or the tissue where the infection is so that they can get into the bugs. If they're absorbed, they then interrupt the metabolism, and then it can't duplicate, it can't replicate, have children, and it dies off.
So they're essentially poisons?
Absolutely, of many sorts.
So, Martha, what is the difference between a virus and a bacteria? Why, for instance, antibiotics will only work against bacteria?
Yes, that's right. Well, a bacteria is a living organism. That all it needs is a source of food and a source of carbon, and it lives. It lives within us. It lives on the food that we digest. They have their own metabolism. They just replicate and grow. Whereas a virus needs a host. So a virus is not living, essentially, until it's infecting something else. So a virus is a very simple thing. It just has a genetic code. Generally, it can have DNA or RNA or both. And then it has a capsid. It has something to keep it safe from the outside environment. But it's an inert particle unless it's infecting something else. So I study viruses that kill bacteria. So everything has its own specific viruses that infect us. So humans do, dogs do, cats do, and bacteria have their own set. And we get very interested in all these viruses that are everywhere that are infecting those bacteria. But actually the most interesting thing about them is when they're infecting those bacteria and causing disease. So a virus will go into a cell and turn it into a viral factory. So when a virus enters a bacteria, it goes in, and about half an hour later, 100 viruses will be released. So it goes in and it says to that bacteria, no, you're not a bacteria anymore. You're a viral-making machine.
Chris, we both did a head-to-head turn exactly. Done, everyone. That was 5 minutes of proper Radio 4 programme. I didn't think we were going to get there. That was all kind of serious with a little light touch as well. Brilliant. Now, Chris, your father was a doctor. How did it go wrong for you?
Yeah, my dad was a doctor. So we grew up in a scrupulously clean house. There was a huge amount of attention paid to health and cleanliness. That's nonsense. There are no doctors like that. I've never met anybody filthier than doctors in general. I think rather than teaching us, it's doctors you should actually be worrying about, Sally. Those are the people who need to know about bacteria and filth, and not in hospitals so much as in their own socks. other accoutrements. Yeah, my dad was a doctor. Yes.
So your dad's going to enjoy... Oh, yet again, Chris has gone on the radio to remind us all that we live in squalor.
No, they don't live in squalor, but equally, doctors... there are no more cavalier people about health than doctors, in my experience. They're the worst at going to doctors themselves. And usually it's, I've broken my leg, really? Well, have an aspirin and lie down for a while. That's generally what you get off a parental doctor.
So not hypochondriacs, because I suppose in one sense that you think of doctors as being aware of all the possible diseases you can get and therefore being worried that they've got them, but your
I think they just I think they just go, well, we're all screwed, aren't we? I mean, we might as well just eat that toast that's been on the floor the last 3 days.
We're fighting a losing battle. Sally, we're going to talk primarily about antibiotics today and what we can do to make them more effective. Could you paint a picture of the world before antibiotics, which most of us don't remember, but it's not too long ago, I suppose, certainly 1930s, 40s and 50s?
Definitely the first half of last century and before. More people died of infection in the First World War and probably the Second than of actually injury. And we reckon that antibiotics have added an average of 20 years to people's lives. So they have really changed. One of the first patients that had penicillin was in the States, and it was a 7-year-old, and she had a scratch on her cheek, her whole mouth swelled up, and it intruded on her breathing, and she was about to die when they tried it, and, 6 days later she walked out a pretty little girl again. So it's absolutely changed the picture of disease. And we've done a lot of modelling, as have the World Bank, and we can see that if we go on the way we are doing, and we can talk about how the problem is getting worse, and actually how we have an empty pipeline of new antibiotics, we know that by 2050, we'll have 10 million people a year dying of drug-resistant infections. That's more than die of cancer at the moment around the world, significantly more. It is a post-antibiotic era is a possibility, and we have to take lots of action to stop it happening, and it would be horrid, and people would be shocked.
Chris, in terms of your background, where you are being brought up in a medical household, I mean, one in a terrible state, as we know, but how has that affected the way that you, I mean, when you hear things like this, when you see, of course, there's a lot of also, you know, pseudoscience out there, have you grown up with a healthy level of scepticism about us being able to understand the nature of human beings, the nature of the medical world?
Well, I think my dad was always very, like a lot of doctors and medical professionals, he's very rude about the medical profession and its place in science. In that he goes, listen, we tried a thing, it worked, and so we're doing it again. And that is fundamentally the science of medicine. It's all just guesswork that's worked out. You're on your own, kid. And that's the most interesting part to me, was that because we all, non-scientists, I think, have the sense of this big thing, this big abstract thing, science, that has the power to solve everything, and all you have to do is push the right buttons and their right answer will ping out the other end. And in fact, medicine is basically, he was saying, you know, it's a few hundred years, mostly the last 100 years, of people really trying something or noticing something by accident. That worked. We'll put that in the book then. And because of that, you come out feeling, oh, there's no system. That doesn't exist. It isn't digital, it's analog.
Since your father's time.
Well, he's still with us, I'm pleased to say, as of the beginning of this recording. I think they might change. Yeah. Unfortunately, the antibiotics he's been taking haven't really been working out. Yeah, so but he was always very, equally about antibiotics, he was always very, don't just go and get the antibiotics. That's not a good, it's not a good solution for you, and it's not a good solution for everyone in general.
Martha, so your research is based, you're looking at a potential alternative for the standard antibiotics, as you mentioned, which is phages.
Yes.
So could you describe what that possibility is?
Sure. So if you have a think, first of all, about what an antibiotic is, it's not just something that we buy from the chemist. An antibiotic is something, generally they're made by bacteria or fungi, and they're part of bacterial warfare. So if you go into, you can take Permian soil, defrost it, and you can find antibiotic resistance tens of thousands of years ago. So it's something that's always been there, bacteria endlessly competing for space and resources and trying to knock each other out. So we've capitalized on that and used these defenses. So that is one natural enemy of bacteria, which is other bacteria and fungi. But another natural enemy of bacteria are the viruses. So as I said, the viruses, bacteria have got their completely own sets of viruses that just target them, and they're really specific within the species. So if you have an E. coli infection, you'd have viruses that just infect that. Or if you have a Clostridium infection, there'll be another set of viruses. So each different type of bacteria has got its own set. So the fact is, nature, nature's already done it. So ever since the 3.9 billion years that bacteria have existed, they've had their own viral enemies. So by studying these, we can find whole sets of new tools in the way these viruses target and kill the bacteria.
Well, this has got, I mean, I was reading the Bacteria News Weekly thing, and there's an incredible, incredible story, though, that this idea is older than antibiotics.
Oh, absolutely.
And why was it antibiotics became that this is what can be, and phages, it's been a long time of kind of just being left in a lot of medical cultures.
Yeah, absolutely. So the discovery of bacteriophages was 101 years ago. So last year we had a series of parties throughout the world to celebrate this.
How many people came to the party?
Not very many.
Oh, no, we've all got diarrhoea. Who mixed this punch? Sorry. It wasn't sexy punch at all. Sorry.
It's a surprising number. we had around 300 or more people at the Pasteur Institute, I think 400 people. But actually, they were discovered 101 years ago by a French-Canadian. But actually, an Englishman discovered them 2 years independently before that. But in sort of typical English style, he wrote it up beautifully in The Lancet. But he didn't have enough funding to continue with his research. So he wrote a very nice thing saying, I've shown you what I've discovered, and I really hope it's useful to you. So he published that, and then it was more or less ignored. He went off and fought in the war. And meanwhile, this French-Canadian chap, Félix Durel, He discovered them independently in the Pasteur Institute, and he's sort of often seemed to be the sort of forefather of bacteriophage research, because he then took them further. So this was in 1917, he found them. 1919, he did his first clinical trial. So he immediately developed them. He looked at Salmonella in chickens, and then he did a study quite early on looking at Shigella, diarrhea, infection in children, and he showed that the viruses worked really well. But he was a bit of a maverick character, and he fell out very badly with the director of the Pasteur Institute and was a little bit sidelined. But then he trained a young Georgian scientist. So often people think about phages and they think, oh, it's something that happened vaguely east, vaguely Russia, Georgia. And that was because there was a young Georgian that trained in the Pasteur Institute, and he was called George Eliava. And he went back to Georgia and set up this institute in 1927 there. He then had a slightly unfortunate ending. He was executed by Stalin for being an enemy of the people. But he also, he'd fallen in love with the girlfriend of the chief of the secret police and joined to Stalin. So anyway, so Durrell therefore fled Georgia at this point.
This is better than Peaky Blinders. This is. Please commission this for 9 o'clock Sunday night.
You've got to direct this.
Yeah, I'm taking copious notes.
But phage research did carry on, so they carried on working on different phages for all sorts of things in Georgia and in Russia. And actually, until in the heyday, they were producing, so in the 60s and 70s, they were producing a couple of tons of phages were produced every year in Georgia and disseminated throughout the whole of the USSR for skin disorders, as intestinal disorders, on all sorts of other bacterial diseases, both of humans and animals. So, or your question to why didn't phages take on? They have this complicated backstory, and then antibiotics just seem so much simpler. you have one compound, you can purify your antibiotics, so you've got one thing, you can make it in easy to produce, you can make a standard dose responses so you can check exactly how they kill bacteria. They're less specific, so they're easier, sort of, all the logistics of making them and using them seemed easier. So at that point, most research on therapeutics and phages, in apart from these pockets I've mentioned, that the therapeutic angle more or less stopped, and people used antibiotics. It just seemed as unnecessary.
But the problem from a physician's perspective is that you have to know precisely what it is that you're aiming
to
treat.
You have to know the strain, the bug, and the strain of the bug. It's very, and you can have lots of strains of any one bug, whereas an antibiotic will kill all the strains of that bug, plus some other bugs if you're lucky. So, and you take it as a tablet, it's very easy, synthesized. So it's much easier and cheaper to use antibiotics. So I'm rather excited about phage. But I mean, I imagine drinking cocktails of phage. Ooh, what E. coli have I got in my gut today? Right, I'm going to need a phage for each of those different strains.
What the Georgians do, the way they use phages, is they have very complicated mixtures. So they'll have a mixture of phages that treat skin diseases, and in that mixture there'll be viruses that target the 6 different main bacteria that live on skin. And then within that, they'll endlessly be looking for new viruses. So they'll find that the most effective ones within that. So they'll have 6 viruses for each of the 6 bacteria. So they have these very, very complicated soups that they give people. So if you go to Georgia and you go to the pharmacies there that are linked with this institute, you see people snaking around the corner, and they're all getting their general, they're just essentially like their general antibiotic. But from a regulatory standpoint, in the West, it's very complicated and expensive to manufacture and difficult to standardize.
Happens as well. So the phage are not immune to the mutational changes, are they, and escape of the bacteria. But if you can get, I prefer cocktail to soup, if you can get the right
Who doesn't?
Cocktail.
Depends on the time of day.
Depends on this, yes. Cocktail, then soup, then your main course. Dinner, brandy, home.
Well, there we are. I prefer the cocktail. Okay. And if you can get the right cocktail, it could be very useful. But there are other approaches too. If you're looking at gut disorders, there are people developing probiotics and things like that are beginning to look quite hopeful at kind of outgrowing the pathogenic, the ill health bugs in your gut and things. So
you mentioned there, by the way, you said that they search for new phages. So how would you, because it's a mystery, so how would you go about finding a disease that attacks a bacteria? Where do you find these things?
So phage biologists hang around in fairly unsavory environments. to find, wherever you find bacteria in high numbers, you will find viruses associated with it. So as I say, all viruses, bacteria have got their own sets of viruses or phages. So a very good source, and many therapeutic phages come from sewage.
Did you know this before you chose this line of work?
No, I used to study ocean bacteria. Sampling was so much nicer. No, it's basically sewage and sputum.
Well, I mean, there are sewage pipes at the beach. You could combine both of those things.
Well, but funnily enough, I have done.
If you see her surfing, walk away from the top.
Most British beaches are pretty good for phages.
Well, they really are. And actually, that was one of my breakthroughs in my Clostridium work. So I spent about 2 years when I started my own research group about 10 years ago. I thought, right, I'll try to find new viruses that target Clostridium difficile, because there's only two in the literature. And I just sort of had that arrogance of new position. No one else has done it right. I will find viruses. So I screened patient diarrheal samples for 2 years. It was really unpleasant. Hundreds of samples. Not a virus, in fact. So then I went back to
What was your favourite sample?
I trained my research technician.
That's abuse. That's technically abuse.
This is the conversation at the party, isn't it?
Yeah.
What was your favourite?
Bring your own. And we do mean booze. We don't mean anything else.
Yeah, it was not a good sampling. So then I went back to the marine environment where I'd sampled a lot before. And because you find Clostridium difficile, you can find it in the environment. You can find it in rivers and in soils and estuaries. So we think of it as being a gut, bad, pathogenic bacteria, but it also lives in the wild. When I went into the wild, that's where I could find my viruses. So by actually going into a sort of more natural state where you have viruses and bacteria interacting, I was able to isolate lots of viruses from that environment.
Sally, how do we search for new antibiotics? Is it entirely synthetic now, or do we still look in the wild for them?
No, we look in the wild. There's been some really nice research recently looking at how to culture soil to find different bacteria from the ones we've found before, and that's looking quite helpful.
We found a big carrot-shaped one, and we found a turnip-shaped one.
And I was at a very exciting presentation of a research group in Germany that is looking at insects, because insects, of course, survive against bacteria, and they have innate antibacterials, and they're finding really interesting compounds. And once you find them, you can work out what they are, you can then look at their efficacy, and then you can synthesize them. So we often look in nature, or generally look in nature, and then you can start to synthesize anything you're interested in. So there are different approaches now, but it's proving awfully difficult.
Because you read that little research spend is directed in this area, compared to cancer, for example.
If we don't find new antibiotics, we will see the end of modern medicine. So cancer comes in here. If you have cancer, your immune system's not working well. But, we use antibiotics to cover most modern medicine.
Yeah.
Replacement hips, cesarean sections.
You can replace hips with antibiotics. Don't they just crumble?
Cover.
They're quite small.
To prevent infections after the operation, yes.
So they're a critical part
they
of virtually every
critical.
Medical procedure.
And the world thought we'd got antibiotics, we'd cracked it. There was a surgeon general a few decades ago in the early 80s who said, we can close the book on infections. And this lack of recognition that mutations would keep going, so we had to keep the pipeline going. We lost a lot of the research in universities. Mm-hmm. You are very special for what you do. Martha, and we need to rebuild that. Mm. So, yes, we don't spend enough. We don't train enough people. We really have to start from the beginning.
There was a lovely moment today where every now and again Brian will see a statistic and he will just question it. And there was a statistic I think we got from you, and Brian went, I don't believe that. And he gets out his pocket calculator, or Jim Al-Khalili as we call him. And the statistic was, it was brilliant, that if you put all the phages end to end, which I presume would be a tricky manoeuvre anyway, but it would be 200 million light years. Is that right?
Yes, that's right. There's an estimated 10 to the 31 bacteriophages on Earth. So it's very hard to imagine this number of
Yeah. No, I didn't believe it, because it sounds ridiculous, doesn't it? If you got all the phages on Earth now and lined them up, it would be 200 million light years long. I thought, that's nonsense.
And that would make it even harder to find the right one.
But I did a little calculate. Yeah, it seems right, from my view, which is quite it astonishing. Like,
well, if Brian says so, then that's fine.
Oh, no, it just sounds...
Chapeau. It's my big question to you about the phages and antibiotics, phages versus antibiotics, is if you get to a point where phages are available to the general population to take for much of the same reasons that we would take antibiotics, will we be able to have alcohol with them? We don't care about resistance, but why can't I have the Chardonnay for 12?
No, I'm afraid alcohol will kill most phages.
What a sad ending to the show. So we asked the audience question as well, and we always find out what they think. This is, today we asked them, if you are feeling a bit under the weather, what is your favourite remedy? And they include the complete box set of Wonders of the Universe, especially... Brian, well done for getting this in. Especially the one where Brian plays with the sand.
Yes.
Not near that beach again. What have you got there?
Jim Alka-Seltzer.
I usually undo some buttons. Most of my feelings of creeping malaise are caused by trying to force myself into clothes I'm too fat for.
What have we got there, Chris?
I've got, from Katie McDonough, I've got, I just get on with it. I'm a woman.
A certain 90s pop synth band, because then things could only get better. Thank you, Joanna.
There it is.
Well, thank you very much. Thank you to our panel, Dame Sally Davis, Chris Addison and Martha Clokey. Next week, you'll have to listen to the show in your bedroom very loudly with your dad downstairs saying, will you turn that science down? Because we are doing a show all about the teenage brain, and we're going to ask what it is, why it is, why Morrissey still has one.
Oh, why won't people leave me alone? Want to stay in bed.
Another niche impression.
Niche impressions. Always the niche impressions. Always the niche. Anyway, thank you very much. I'm Robin Ince, and I'm Brian Cutts.
That's what... They'll never know. They'll never know he left early. Thank you very much for listening. Bye-bye. In the infinite monkey
cage. You're now nice again.
Hello, I'm Robin Ince.
And I'm Brian Cox.
Today we ask, was Brian's pop career just a phase he was going through due to the changing structures of his teenage brain before he entered the adulthood of being a particle physicist?
And why did Robin remain trapped in the perpetual adolescence of being a stand-up comedian?
Shut up, Brian. You're such an idiot. Anyway, I am now a serious Radio 4 broadcaster somewhere between Melvin Bragg and Nicholas Parsons, which is how I got the job.
Today we discuss the science of teenagers. What physiological changes occur in the brain during the teenage years? Is there an evolutionary explanation for them? Do these changes occur in other animals? And why didn't these changes reach completion in Robin Ince?
You are being so extra. I have no idea what that means, but I asked some teenagers, said extra was very much the word for the moment. So now, watch me Radio 4 this intro, right, if you don't think I've got it. Today, we explore the teenage brain. We have three eminent grown-ups, and they are...
I'm Professor Matthew Cook from the University of Manchester, and the strangest thing that I did as an adolescent was to think that I could write poetry. I'm afraid I think I actually sent a whole bundle of them off to Ted Hughes, who didn't reply, which is probably the best thing.
I'm Professor Sarah Jane Blakemore from UCL. I'm a cognitive neuroscientist. And yeah, I'm not sure it's the strangest thing, but maybe one of the more risky things I did as a teenager was to hitchhike around the south of France with my friend Kath, occasionally ending up in lorries or vans, one time in the boot of someone's car, just to get to the beach.
I'm Rory Bremner. I'm a fellow of King's College, and I have an honorary doctorate in advanced mimicry from Heriot Watt University. And the strangest thing I did as a teenager, the riskiest thing I did as a teenager, was to run through a field of wheat. Oh, sorry.
And this is our panel. Before we continue, by the way, we should make it quite clear that in no way does this show recommend you climb in the boot of anyone's car. So, Rory, first, what for you defines what you think of as a teenager?
Moody, insecure, impulsive, impressionable, sorry, that's Donald Trump, isn't it? No, I would say, well, actually, a lot of those still apply. Emotional, hormonal, anxious, desperate to fit in. I think all of those are part of teenage years, so they certainly were for me.
So that is that for you is the archetype or what our presumption that we would make. I think that's pretty true. That kind of that straight, you know, the mixture of attempting to be gregarious, but also at the same time that, you know, desire for loneliness, the staying in your room and the.
Well, there are so many contradictions. Quentin Crisp got it right about this, as about so many other things. He said, the thing about teenagers is they have the same problem, how to rebel and conform at the same time. And they manage this by defying their parents and copying each other. So there's that contradiction of rebelling and conforming, but also to be an individual, but also peer pressure, which is the biggest thing. I mean, it was particularly my school, because, in fact, a lot of the children went on to become members of the House of Lords. But I can remember that the pressure to all the lads, you remember as a teenager, I used to so look up to the lads because they seemed so cool and so dangerous, and I wanted to be one of them. And then the other day I actually met one of the people who I thought was the biggest lad in the school, and he just left the army and become an estate agent.
Yeah, I saw that. I looked up someone the other day who was the most rebellious kid, and he works for British American Tobacco, so there we are.
Sarah, there are, I suppose some of those descriptions of teenagers are almost clichéd, but in a scientific sense, is there a fundamental difference between a teenager and an adult?
Yes, there is. There's a lot of evidence that teenagers go through a period of their life where they're more self-conscious and more moody. That's probably the hormones. But also things like risk-taking seems to be heightened during the teenage years in adolescence. That's in adolescent humans and in non-human species of animals as well, like rats and mice go through a period of heightened risk-taking when they go through their adolescence. And as Rory mentioned, peer influence, that seems to peak in adolescence. So adolescents are more influenced by their friends than children are or adults are.
And you mentioned the hormones there. That tends to be the sort of the idea that everybody puts forward, that hormonal changes in your body and that makes you more moody. But is there more than that? Are there physiological differences?
Yeah, so when I was an undergraduate 25 years ago, that's what I was taught. I was taught that teenage behaviour is all down to hormones, changes at of sex hormones at puberty, and changes from going to a little primary school to a big secondary school with lots of new faces and lots of new people. But that was because 25 years ago, we had no idea what's going on in the brains of teenagers. We didn't have the ability to look inside the living human brain to look at how it changes across the lifespan. We now do. We use MRI scanning to scan the living human brain of all ages. And for the last 20 years, lots of different labs around the world have been doing that. And we now have a really rich picture of how the teenage brain develops. And the idea that the brain stops developing in childhood, which is another thing that I learned when I was an undergraduate, is completely wrong. And in fact, the human brain continues to develop right throughout childhood, right throughout adolescence, and even into the early 20s.
Because it's about adult size, at 8 or 9 years old, isn't it? So it's not size that changes, it's the construction, the architecture of the brain itself.
Yeah, so the volume of the brain, the size of the brain, reaches adult levels by about age 8 or 9. It's not that that changes. It's the structure of the brain, how its composition, how much grey matter it has and how much white matter it has, and also how it functions, how it becomes activated when you do a certain task, like, for example, when you take a risk or you make a decision or you inhibit an inappropriate response.
Matthew, do we see a period of adolescence in all animals? I mean, we always joke about the fact that you do some work on maggots. Do you, is there a kind of a grumpy teenage fly that, you know, it goes into that excrement just deliberately to then leave footprints of poo on your cake, you know, as an act of rebellion? Or do we see a cut-off point of those that don't have of adolescent experience?
I think basically the what we find is that in mammals in particular, then there is a period of change, hormonal change, to do with the passage into adulthood. And that is associated, as Sarah Jane says, with lots of risk-taking and changes. In particular, when we say risk-taking, we're not talking about them, you know, trying to jump off cliffs or anything. They will, rats and mice will be much more interested in novel objects. So if you're a rat or a mouse, it's a really dangerous thing. Something new in your cage is worrying. So you won't go towards it. And what happens is that the rats and mice will show a much shorter latency to respond to that. They'll start going out and sniffing it and be interested in it. So you can get something which we interpret as risk-taking, but is in fact basically just a lowering of the threshold at which they're ready to move. Normally an adult rat will take some time and be very, very wary. But a juvenile adolescent rat will be much more quick to respond.
And what's the time scale there for a rat? How old are you to be, if you want to be a teenage rat?
Rats go through about 30 days of adolescence when they're about 30 days old.
Right.
So 30 days of adolescence.
And then
30 days of adolescence.
And mice the same. And there was a nice study published a couple of years ago showing that adolescent mice drink more alcohol when they're with other adolescent mice. And that's not true for adult mice. Adult mice drink the same amount of alcohol whether they're on their own or with their cage mates.
There are some outtakes from Bagpuss which really changes. They are not marvellous and mechanical.
But actually, it does, doesn't it look like, as you said before, the perfect storm, really, because you've got all the hormones, but at the same time, as we now know, all this activity that's happening in the brain, it's like a cosmic trick how teenagers, when they're vulnerable, are exposed to all of this at the same time.
Yes, I mean, it is. It's like a perfect storm. They're going through changes in both physically with their sex hormones and their bodies change. That means that society treats them differently. You might know a lot more about that, Matthew, because it's true for non-human species too. And also their brains are undergoing huge amounts of change, and their social environment is changing. Their social environment becomes really chaotic and unstable, where people are trying to work out where they are in social hierarchies. All these changes put together mean that adolescence is quite a vulnerable time. It's a time in life where if you're going to develop a mental illness, it's very likely to start in your adolescence. But it's also a time of heightened plasticity. So it's a time of opportunity for things like learning and rehabilitation and therapy and that kind of thing.
You mentioned the ratio between grey matter and white matter in the brain changes. So what is the difference between those two things?
So grey matter is found in the surface of the brain, which is called the cortex, and contains brain cells, so neurons and the connections between neurons and various other types of cell, whereas white matter is the long tracts, the fibres that connect up different regions of the brain together. And what we know about how grey matter and white matter change during adolescence is that grey matter increases during childhood. It peaks. The amount of grey matter you have in your brain is at its highest in late childhood or early adolescence, and then it undergoes a very steady, slow, and substantial decline right throughout adolescence. So in other words, during adolescence, grey matter is actually declining, and then it stabilises in the 20s. Now, that might sound like a bad thing. Decline sounds like maybe it's kind of degenerating or something. It's not. We know that because, first of all, it stabilizes in the 20s for many decades. And we know that the changes in gray matter relate to really important neurodevelopmental changes that are going on in the brain that allow the brain to develop according to the environment that the animal or the child finds itself in.
Is it sort of chucking out the things that it doesn't need?
Yeah, well, so one of the things that's changing and contributes to this decline in grey matter during adolescence is that synapses are being pruned away. So synapses are the connections between brain cells. What the brain does is it massively overproduces the number of synapses that you need. So a child has many more synapses in its brain than an adult does. And so then what has to happen is that the synapses, the connections that aren't being used, need to be whittled away. And that is done by this process called synaptic pruning. The synapses that aren't being used in a particular environment are the ones that get pruned away, they get eliminated, and the synapses that are being used in a particular environment are the ones that remain and get strengthened.
So is it a bit like a mobile phone or so that downloads all these hundreds and hundreds of apps, and they're all running away like mad in the background, and gradually through adolescence, and particularly towards late adolescence, it's just getting rid of the apps it doesn't need?
Yeah, making it probably a more, I mean, we don't tend to use the word efficient, but yes, making it a more kind of efficient network of synaptic connections. The other thing that's happening is that white matter is increasing during adolescence. So the fibers that connect up different brain regions together are increasing right throughout childhood and throughout adolescence, and you can see that as an increase in white matter. And that makes the brain more speedy. It speeds up the time it takes signals to move from one neuron to the other.
Matthew, yes,
I think one of